This is Isaka's Page 2 Podcast.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. I'm John Brandt, Isaka's Information Security Professional Practices Lead, and I'm excited to be here with Renju from HCL Technologies. Renju, thank you so much for joining us. If you wouldn't mind giving our listeners and our viewers a little bit of background in your current role.
Thanks, John. It's my pleasure to be part of this particular event and session with you. My name is Renju Varghese. I am the fellow and chief architect for cybersecurity and GRC at HCL. Been part of this team for the last 22 years. As part of my day-to-day function that I do with my different clients is to understand their needs, identify where do they stand, what should be the roadmap, how do they plan to address their cybersecurity and GRC portfolio, as well as the landscape and what should be the roadmap and how they go about achieving it, along with identifying what should be the newer trends, activities that we see, and how we should be working and helping each one of our clients to be at their best on the responses, detection, and protecting themselves from cybersecurity threats.
Wow, that's a lot of time that you've been at HCL there. You've obviously seen a lot of different things, you know, the industry kind of evolving over time. Really eager to hear what your insights are and your perspectives as we kind of talk about the Isaka State of Cybersecurity Part 2 report, which HCL was a sponsor of. So we're just going to jump right into this. You know, nothing has been normal for the last year or two, but what stands out to you most about the current state of the cyber threat landscape?
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting aspects has been, if you look at the time that was the last 18 months, which was, or just over 18 months, which was the time for the COVID-19 pandemic, yeah, one of the biggest aspects that we have seen is that the threat actors did not relatively take advantage of that pandemic to disrupt the clients in clients' environments. Yeah, but at the same time, we've seen higher instances of attacks that is taking place or attempts of attacks taking place into the client's infrastructure. We've also seen a very interesting aspect was that there has been a reduction of insider threats, while there has been a more prevalent increase in the fact of social engineering and using social engineering trying for breaking into the network environment to infiltrate and make an attempt to disrupt. So that's been a very interesting fact. The last is with respect to the remote working models have been mandated or have been forced on most organizations as part of the pandemic. And what we started to also see as part of this report is where these remote working models are driving a better adoption of newer strategies such as SASE and Zero Trust that the client should want to adopt and use those strategies to improve their cybersecurity postures.
So let me ask you, this is really kind of outside of the report, but based on all of the other reporting that you might follow and then your own personal experience, you know, within your day-to-day job, would you say that, you know, COVID-19 has really kind of, it broke the business as usual mindset? Did it make it easier for people to gain executive buy-in to do things a little differently?
Yeah, I think it did bring in a lot of focus from the executives or the board as well as the senior executives of the organization to look at cybersecurity as in a much more serious light. And that has brought in a much more focus from the executives, but from the normal cybersecurity teams as well as the IT teams, they have been more confident in the way how they could run their systems or they've been able to run their systems and provide for a secure computer environment.
Yeah, I think those are great perspectives there. And it seemed to be, of all of the bad things that the pandemic brought about, there were some there were some positive things, obviously, in the ways of efficiencies and just that ability to be a little bit more flexible, right, with the mindset. And we just saw that whereas remote work was largely not as prevalent before the pandemic, and a lot of corporate opinions have changed, not only because there's some business, you know, business savings, cost savings from real estate and whatnot, but there's been a lot of comments on as to productivity going up. So fortunately, there were some silver linings to be had here. As we move along here, one of the things that came out of the report was 77% of respondents expressed confidence in their team's ability to detect and respond to threats. And that was an increase of 3 percentage points from the year before. Did that surprise you at all, given everything, you know, just the pandemic change, a lot of things decentralized and whatnot?
Yeah, I think that that is a very interesting aspect, which was brought out as part of the report, is the improved confidence in the detection and ability to respond. You know, why it was a surprise is the fact that, you know, when most of the teams and most of these functions were operating remotely, which means that, yeah, there was no close interaction from a physical standpoint, or those water cooler conversations to identify and interact and identify potential problems or potential areas that somebody's trying to infiltrate or somebody's trying to break in. Yeah, and what should be the response? Now, when you take those water cooler kind of conversations out and have people and the incident responders all sitting at remote locations in their houses, and how do they interact? And that brings a different perspective to it. And hence, it was very surprising to find that increased confidence, which means that there was a very, very strong mechanisms of how these individuals belonging to different teams have been interacting and trying to maintain a better secure environment for at their respective enterprises.
As I hear, you know, as I listen to what you were saying and your thoughts there, it's almost as if by forcing operations outside of, you know, the physical workplace where most of the people were, there was an extra emphasis on visibility, right? Because you can't protect what you don't see, or what you know, what you don't know you have. And perhaps with that move to a lot of essential operations being handled remotely, that the that security teams were able to kind of double down with a fresh perspective.
Yes. So one of the aspects which I was mentioning is that since all of us are humans, the basic interchange and that spark of new thoughts come in because of the fact that, you know, when we interact face-to-face with our colleagues, be it on a problem, be it on what we are seeing, and hence try to interact with different perspectives and identify different avenues of what might be potentially an attempt to break in. Now, when you take this, disrupt this face-to-face interactions and take it remote is what actually the pandemic brought in, by forcing most of the folks to be working from their respective homes and interacting through other collaborative mediums such as, you know, Teams, Zoom, or any of those kind of collaborative mediums. But it also brings in and breaks that basic established function of having those face-to-face interactions, those water cooler discussions, to also interact and interchange perspectives to find out if there is a new model of attack, or there is a new channel or a new method of somebody trying to attempt to break in into the system. Now, those things have all been disrupted as part of the pandemic, and that's the reason which was very interesting and surprising that, you know, being remote, there was also this new fabric which was created of interchange, interaction between these different teams to identify and jointly maintain a much more secure environment.
When we opened the conversation, you had touched on the fact that respondents largely didn't feel that bad actors had taken advantage of the pandemic specifically, right? And that's interesting in itself because, as a rule of thumb, right, bad actors take advantage of abnormal circumstances, whether it be weather, something like a pandemic, you know, any kind of crisis, right? It's because there's that little bit of chaos that ensues there. So I think about that. And then we look at this point that only 5% of respondents reported fewer attacks, which on the surface makes a lot of sense. You know, I don't think that anybody in the middle of the pandemic would have ever thought, you know, even at that percentage, that they would think that attacks would go down, because really what we've seen is bad actors are, you know, they're not really discriminatory, right? Like they just, if you have bad security, more than likely you become a very lucrative target because it becomes a low effort, high reward type thing. So do you expect to see, you know, as we get ready, Isaka gets ready to release the next survey, right? Do you think into 2022 that this next report that we're going to see more people, a larger percentage report a downtick in cyber attacks? Or do you think that this is probably about the best that we can expect and that a lot of people are just going to, you know, might even perhaps be swayed by all the increased industry reporting that's out there?
I think the downtick in attacks, you know, we will not see more respondents reporting a downtick in attacks in the next report next year. That's my take to it. The reason for it is that what we have seen as part of this particular report is also there's been higher number of attacks. What we've also seen by the other industry reports is the complexity and the innovativeness for the attacks have drastically improved. We've seen that happen in few of the attacks, such as the SolarWinds part of the attack or the Colonial Pipeline attacks. So these are going to be having larger impacts. We will have exactly like what you mentioned, John, about some of the respondents being swayed into believing there are more attacks. That's one aspect of it. And at the same time, we'll also start to see more respondents reporting they have experienced more complex or more attempts to break in into their systems. So that's what I believe is going to take place as far as we move into the next year and look at new perspectives in the next year.
That's a great point. You know, and again, just to deviate, when we see one of the big concerns that I have within the industry, and this is just technology in general and business in general, is the more mergers and acquisitions and movement to just a few major players increases risk. We look at outages that happen, you know, that have happened with Microsoft Teams and Office 365, and Facebook was a very recent one, right? A lot of impact. And even today, you know, on the day that we're recording this, Xfinity had widespread outages across the nation. So there is that, right? The internet was never created to be centralized, and yet we continue to see this trend towards consolidations, which then, you know, for the person, you know, such as yourself or, you know, or anybody who's been in industry for so long, it's kind of hard to not see the writing on the wall that it becomes yes, it's going to take a more effort on the part of a bad actor. But if they're able to exploit any kind of vulnerability or disrupt anything in that particular technology or supply chain, it has a much larger effect, and to which a company, especially smaller to medium enterprises, they could literally do everything right with the exception of maybe not have a failover for something like a SaaS application. And they have widespread business disruption.
John, one of the interesting aspects to this kind of evolution of attacks or the evolution of newer models of disruption is the is the very basic ability to identify, yes, there is somebody sitting in, or there has been a breach, and there is going to be a potential attack, or there is going to be a potential disruption. Now, that ability to detect becomes more and more critical to this fact. And that ability to detect is purely based on increased skilled cybersecurity professionals who are able to look through and see through the different kinds of events and patterns to exactly identify something is going wrong. I think that's where this need of having better skilled and a constant requirement for upskilling and improve the current skill capability of all the cybersecurity professionals come into play. I think that's going to be the interesting aspect too of what we are seeing from all of these attacks that's taking place, and the innovative attacks or the groundbreaking attacks that we are seeing in the last 1 year or so.
You know, you just upskilling and workforce development, that's near and dear to my heart. What we're seeing, right, is, you know, you've obviously been in this industry a long time, and just as I have. And I think back to my early days coming up through, you know, doing IT work predominantly, we were really highly reliant upon vendor training, vendor credentialing. And, you know, when we talk about the consolidations to, you know, there's only a couple major, cloud platforms out there, right? So now all of a sudden, that plus every vendor specific tool that, you know, an enterprise wants to look at, there's a training component to that. And it is one of those things that we can't dismiss it, because it's this blend between the vendor neutral, having the vendor neutral approach and just analytical abilities in that quest for knowledge, right? To kind of find that digital needle in a haystack, as well as sufficient technical knowledge of whatever tool or technology you're using to provide your insights, as well as your operations. We're going to pivot here for a second. Let's talk about cyber maturity and cyber assessments. Within our report, one of the insights we wanted to kind of dive into was this notion of, does it really matter whether the security team reported to the CISO or CIO? And there were a couple instances where there were some marked differences. And that really, you know, will kind of encourage readers to kind of dig into that, and they can read that, the report off, you know, on their own time. But what was interesting is 65% of respondents said that they assess cyber maturity, and that's a good thing. However, the primary driver for why they were doing it was compliance. So, you know, obviously there's some concern there. Whereas that might be the main driver, if that's the only reason we're doing it and we're not taking a risk-based approach, we have lots of reports over the years that just show that that's not a very effective way of going about it. Where do you think that cyber maturity assessments are going to fit into an enterprise's holistic program over time?
I think the most interesting aspect of cybersecurity maturity assessments, like, you know, what we saw in the report, is that it's been driven more by compliance, and that is forcing many of the organizations to undertake the cybersecurity assessments. But what's also interesting coming out as part of the report is the way how the executives have been looking at the cybersecurity assessments, maturity assessments, and looking at, yeah, whether that's giving the right indication of the cybersecurity posture for the organization. What's also interesting from the report is the fact that the organizations that has performed cybersecurity maturity assessments have got better staffed teams and have also got a better outlook and towards their cybersecurity budgets, and hence got better allocations for the cybersecurity budgets. That's also a very interesting aspect. But what is interesting is that while this might have started out being driven by compliance, I believe that more and more organizations will start to see the advantage of having a robust or a periodic cybersecurity assessment as a regime being implemented, being carried out, so as to look at the state of cyber posture that the organization is doing. What's the kind of risk that the organization is being exposed to, and are there measures that is, or adequate measures that's been taken by the organization to reduce those risks so as to have an improved posture? I think that's going to be a very interesting aspect. And I believe that in the coming years, we'll start to see cybersecurity maturity assessments being undertaken in a much more holistic, all-encompassing fashion, but not only driven by compliance, but to also to determine the areas that investments has to be made and improvements will have to be made.
So I think that's a really, those are some really good points there. And I think one of the things that just, it's worth stressing is this quest for making data-informed decisions, right? I think the industry largely, we were plagued with a lot of reaction-based buying and, you know, investments. And I recall many years ago having conversations with, at some of the ISACA conferences, and this struggle, right, to convince executives, we spent quite a bit of money in some investment, but in some technology, in some capability, and then there's a point where it either no longer serves your needs or it never served your needs. And then having to kind of convince the CFO why we need to basically abandon that and replace it. And I think that's some of the challenges in where I'm hearing a lot of folks talk about that rip and replace, is just not, it's not realistic. We thought for many years, well, just take it all out and start over. Well, it's not going to happen, right? So I think that some of the newer technology that are coming about are seem to kind of triage that and to kind of create an umbrella of sorts around it, right? To help protect and add yet another layer to preserve what was already invested, but then kind of give some newer assurance and maybe some visibility that wasn't there before.
The aspect of changing technology or replacing existing investments with newer technology or newer investments is not the only, or would no longer provide the right set of responses or protection. What is also interesting as we go through this evolution process of adoption of new technologies by business and hence potential new avenues for securing data and providing for a secure compute environment or a secure environment for the enterprise, is the fact of more and more data points or activities which is getting reported by different systems of IT. And hence, the need for adopting better solutions which can kind of help in better detection, better identification, technologies such as artificial intelligence, or when a quantum computing aspect would kind of become more mature to be constant, to be used for better predictability, for better detection, and helping the human respondents to identify what should be the right response to those incidents, to the activities that's going on. I think that's where we will start to see better adoption of newer technology solutions like artificial intelligence or quantum computing in future.
I think I would add on, we could just kind of put a bow on this too, that there's, I think it's hard to overlook the need for cooperation too. And, the information sharing activities that exist, the ISACs or the public-private partnerships or these global partnerships that are starting to emerge become really important. And it is, I don't know that there's any easy fix to that. There's no easy button per se, right? Because especially depending on the enterprise, they're very sensitive to the types of information that they share out there. What I did find promising in this year's report is we saw a marked increase in willingness by respondents to basically answer questions without defaulting to prefer not to answer. And I think that there is just a good indicator of what our need to kind of, you know, you can't go it alone, right? So to speak, like this is in a hyper-connected world, we're more reliant upon one another. We're going to wrap up this interview here today. And, you know, no cyber podcast can ever happen without talking about ransomware, and to which there's been no shortage of incidents this year. Rightfully so, it gets a lot of attention. We're not going to delve into the business decisions in decision-making about ransoms. But from your perspective and based on, you know, your experience over time, what's your advice to our listeners and our viewers here about how to better prepare themselves to deal with ransomware attacks that just continue to not only escalate, but are becoming more pervasive?
I think it's become more pervasive, you're right. It's also becoming more and more complex. I think one of the critical things that we will have to do is identify what are the systems and data which are critical, have frequent backups. Yeah, so that there is at least a potential possibility to roll back and restore a system or data from a last known backup which is not infected by ransomware, if in case there has been a complete disruption. So that's the first aspect. The second critical aspect is also to look at, while we look at our applications, our enterprise applications, I believe it's also important to look at alternate models of, you know, if in case an application or a system business process is down, is there an alternate process which can be kicked in to drive and address that disruption without causing damage to the organization. So that's all that I could say to this particular response, because while it's very painful to have a ransomware and to go through all those aspects of identifying the keys, you know, having the negotiation, going through the payments, etc., it's more important to have a very safe, secure, reliable backups which can be used to restore systems and stand up much faster.
Those are all great points there, and I love the fact that you really made it a point to emphasize the need to have backup processes, right? An alternate way of processing. And I think we look at, you know, just how the world is moving today. It's largely a digital first world. It's hard to see to not see the impact if power outage goes down, if the credit card point of service machine has no connectivity. It's like businesses are just really, they don't know how to handle it. And I don't know. And again, there's no easy solution here other than the fact of, as the world races to address the digital divide, there's also this resiliency component, right? And business continuity that can't be overlooked, and how you do that. That's all the time we have today. I want to thank all of our viewers and listeners for joining us. I want to thank my guest, Renju, for his expertise in commenting on Isaka's 2021 State of Cybersecurity Part 2 report, to which his company was a sponsor this year. I hope you got as much out of this as I did. Thank you very much. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today for this episode of Page to Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode.